sertamu.
Namaste and blessings, Sadhguru Nath Maharaj Ki Jai. Welcome to Meditative Living with your host, Swami Shivananda Giri, here on the home of Meditative Living and other very interesting programs. Type1Radio.com. That's radio.com. Thank you ever so much for being there on the other end, Sonic, over there in Brighton, UK. He's the guy that's behind the buttons and making this all sound as good as it possibly can. Now, on today's episode of Meditative Living, we continue our exploration of a text called The Authoritative Guru Gita of H.H. Mahamandaleshwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj, who is this Swami's guru. And this text was translated from the original Sanskrit by Acharya Padma Najendra. And the commentary was written by Swami Anantananda Giri. Now, if you've been with us through the six episodes leading up to this seventh, you will know that we are still in the commentary section following verse 42. Excuse me. Don't know. It must be, you know, there's that rumor out there that 42 is somehow the answer to everything. I was incorrect. We are in the commentary following verse 64. Now, here's the thing. Here's what's going on in the authoritative Guru Gita. It is a conversation between Lord Shiva and his wife, Parvati. And what led up to this is that Shiva was sitting and teaching the science of yoga and the many different ways and everything about the ways of becoming enlightened and liberated while in the human condition. He was teaching these things to a group called the Shapta Rishis, the seven first students of yoga, the first human students of yoga. Shiva is the Adi Yogi, or the Adi Guru, the very first yogi and the very first guru. Now, he was teaching to these rishis. A rishi is a seer. And as he was doing his discourse, Parvati observed Shiva bowing. Well, this totally bewildered her, because Shiva is the god of all gods, and everyone, from the demons to Indra, the king of the gods, Vishnu, Brahma, all of them bow to Shiva. Who in the world is Shiva bowing to? So she asks Shiva to explain this. Now, she is already fully realized. She was already enlightened and liberated at that point. And perhaps later we'll go into the story of how Shiva came to not just give this to her, but then to humanity as well, beginning with the Shapta Rishis. But she sees Shiva bowing and then asks, what are you bowing to? Who in the world would you bow to? Okay. Because he had already gotten her to the state of enlightenment and liberation. But it was very simple with her because they were man and wife. So in her, there was not all the doubt of a normal student who's not that close to Shiva. So when he gave her the instructions and led her, because he didn't teach her a whole lot, he just gave her the methods she used to then reach the supreme level and then function in her role as Shakti, as the active agency of Shiva, which alone can do nothing. But that's the setup. So, returning to the commentary from verse 64, Swami Anantananda Giri goes into the five obscuring coverings. Now, kindly allow the Swami to just read from Swami Anantananda Giri's commentary. In addition to being beyond the five elements and all of their corresponding outer manifestations and inner experiences, the true nature of the guru, of one's own self, is beyond kala and every other force of obscuration as well. According to the philosophy of Kashmir Shaivism, Shiva created everything that exists by willingly subjecting himself to his own power of concealment. He concealed his true nature from himself for the sake of experiencing his own manifold nature, his own manyness. Shiva can't be just any one particular person, place, or thing. unless he forgets the true nature of his oneness and seemingly becoming an individual who is cut off from the vast majority of existence. Thus, having forgotten the self, Shiva sports about in creation as the creation. The guru of our guru, Baba Muktananda of Ganesh Puri, very, very often would say, God exists within you as you. It is these very words and this very concept to which he was referring. Back to the text, Swami Anantananda's commentary. This is the play of consciousness. This is the divine drama, comedy, tragedy, and sport all at once. Aware of his own all-encompassing nature, Shiva possesses five powers. Number one, omnipotence. Number two, omniscience. Number three, perfect completeness. Number four, freedom from natural law. And number five, eternality. When Shiva becomes the individual Jiva, remember, for those of a Western Christian type upbringing, Jiva, soul, same basic concept. When Shiva becomes the individual Jiva, he obscures himself by his own power of concealment. This power can be broken down into five coverings or veils. These are the five powers, but with the noteworthy addition of having limitation superimposed on them. To become the limited individual that is we, the Jivas, is to be Shiva, still possessing all the powers inherent in being Shiva, but only to a limited extent. The five powers under concealment, these five veils, are number one, the power of limited action. Number two, the power of limited knowledge. Number three, the power of attachment. Number four, the power of natural law. And number five, the power of time. Thus, the Jiva has gone from being able to do anything to only being able to perform actions in a very limited way. He retains the power of knowing, but the capacity for knowledge is now limited. While not absent, his powers of action and knowledge are now only partially manifested. Previously, Shiva was perfect, complete, and full. As the Jiva, you know, those of us who see, think, and believe that we are separate from others and other things. What seems good for others may seem bad for oneself. What seems good for others may seem bad for oneself. understand this. And it may, what seems good for oneself may come at the expense of other jivas. As a limited individual, it does not seem to be okay for some of the things that can occur to occur. Certain things seem desirable and, as such, are clung to, while others seem undesirable and thus are avoided. This is the power of limitation superimposed upon Shiva's fullness. All of us limited forms of Shiva fall within the matrix of natural law. As such, when he is in this forgetting state, he is subject to the law of cause and effect, the laws of physics, the influence, for better or worse, of the planets and other cosmic energies, etc., etc. Thus, Shiva accepted the limitation of forces necessary to maintain balance, cohesion, and equilibrium among all his apparently disparate and separate forms. That's us. Finally, all of Shiva's manifestations fall under the segregating jurisdiction of time. Eternality with interstices, beginnings, middles, endings, imposed upon it. Nothing manifest ultimately withstands the advancing conquest of time. Every limited form of Shiva is subject to Shiva's own cyclical functions of creation, sustenance, and dissolution. Everything is born, exists for a while, and then disappears, only to be born again and again until that limited fraction, that little spark from the divine bonfire, remembers its true nature as Shiva. All this repeats. And then the individual is trapped in the cycle of samsara until the coverings of Kala Shakti, the distinction of time and space, and the rest have been directly and consciously transcended. Shloka 64, or verse 64, if you prefer, tells us that the guru is of the nature of consciousness, beyond all elements, beyond all phenomena, and beyond all limitation. It is the limitation superimposed upon Shiva that gives rise to the sense of separation and individuality. The guru is utterly pure and blemishless. Nothing superimposed upon guru to obscure the true nature. This being the guru's experience, he or she is the embodiment of supreme peace. Now, allow this Swami to step away from the text for a moment and once again remind, in this circumstance, we are speaking of the guru in both the limited, individuated, embodied situation and the completely transcendent, both. at the same time. It's very, very important to understand that guru has different meanings depending on the context that it is used. So it can be the individual human being who has reached the state of fullness. And that very state of fullness itself is the big S self. And guru, an individual human who has reached this, may or may not, just depends, then be tasked with assisting other individuated units of consciousness to experience this within themselves. Then that becomes a limited, embodied, two-eyed, two-armed guru within a human body. On to number 65. Shiva says to Parvati, prostrations unto the guru, who is pure, who is beyond the three gunas, everything moving and unmoving, and who pervades the entire universe. Swami Anantananda's commentary. In the previous shloka, we established that the guru is beyond all the elements, all phenomena, and the limitation intrinsic to individuality and manifestation as any particular form. As such, it was implied that he who is Shiva, who is the big S self, is also beyond all the qualities of nature. Here, it is stated explicitly. The guru is Purusha, both transcendent and immanent, immanent meaning limited, individuated. He or she transcends everything that exists, being the whole of which everything else is a part. Yet, somehow, he also exists within everything that exists. As above, so below. There is nothing that is not God. Now, allow this Swami to step away once again and impress the fact that even when an individuated unit of consciousness performs the function of guru, they will continue, because of the human aspect of their nature, to have a personality, behaviors, all of that part is still in effect. And even though they are both limited and transcendent, there will be aspects to that human which are limited aspects. Which means they may say things in a way you don't like. They may do things you don't agree with. But that's okay, because they're still human too, see? We have to really deeply understand the task and the reality of the guru, both in the transcendent and in the limited. Moving on, number 66, Shiva says, the guru alone is the father, mother, relative, and the deity. Sri Guru is the destroyer of attachment to delusion, prostrations unto such a guru. Swami Anantananda's commentary. These are all sources of comfort, places of refuge, and figures of authority, the father, the mother, the relative, and the deity. These are generally the most beloved features of the individual's life. But all of these are the guru only. To think otherwise is delusion. The guru destroys this illusion, and consequently, the seeker is able to know the love that is all-encompassing, unshakable, and from which the love of all others comes into being. The comfort found in the light of knowledge, supreme knowledge, is supreme and unfaltering. It is the only comfort that cannot be taken away. The guru, being the source and essential nature of all things, is the supreme authority. Thus, one should seek refuge in the guru above all else. In a moment, we'll be back with number 67, Sonic. Let's run the bottom of the hour break song, and we'll be back in a moment on Meditative Living.
Shiva.
Namaste and blessings. The Swami welcomes you with great love and great respect from the heart of all. Welcome back to Meditative Living. Number 67 and number 68, Shiva said to Parvati, "Prostrations unto the Guru, by whose potentiality the world obtains its reality, by whose light it is illumined, and from whose bliss it derives its happiness. That in which the entire universe resides, by whose light everything is illumined, and by whose delight suns and others are dear to us. To such a guru I offer my prostrations." Swami Anantananda's commentary. Now on the topic of guru's light. Remember, guru means the first syllable, gu, refers to darkness or ignorance, which is simply not knowing. Ru refers to resplendent light or the knowledge that removes the ignorance. Swami Anantananda Giri says, "The sun is the brightest thing that can be observed in this phenomenal world. Yet the universe contains innumerable such suns, likely some that are larger and or brighter than our own. All of these have come into being by and are of the guru only. In its totality, everything that is forms the body of the guru, the body of consciousness absolute. It is all the Shakti of Shiva. And yet, the Pratyabhijna Hridayam," this is another ancient text and scripture, "tells us that, quote, consciousness unfolds the universe upon but a portion of itself," end quote. The guru's light isn't just the physical light of the stars, though. The guru is the one, quote, "by whose light everything is illumined," end quote. Put another way, it is only by the guru's power that we are able to know anything at all. As discussed above in 64, one of the five attributes of Shiva slash guru is that of omniscience. His knowledge is all-encompassing. In order to become an individual jiva, the guru tattva's own fivefold nature is filtered through five self-imposed limiting factors. In the individual, we find that via the agency of the Lord's jnana shakti, there is knowledge, but it is incomplete. Being created in God's image, the individual partakes of Shiva's innate ability to know things. Thus, our knowledge, any knowledge, is the Lord's own nature manifest within us. The light of the guru is that which dispels the darkness of ignorance. The light of the guru is knowledge itself. Now, let us discuss Guru's love as our own delight. Swami Anantananda comments, "The love of every devoted parent for all of their respective children is only a limited expression of the infinite and perfect love of the divine. Any worth to be found in all one's progeny and ancestry combined is only a taste of that. Your delight in whatever it is that delights you is a great thing. It is a reflection of something intrinsic to Shiva himself. Yet, until the delight of knowing everything as the Shiva self only is found, any joy that is obtained can only be partial and transitory. It is only the reality of the consciousness from which this world issues forth by which the latter can be considered real in any sense of the word real. The universe is only real insofar as it is Shiva's eternal act of becoming. In a sense, everything is real. If it can be imagined, it is real. Conversely, something that can't be imagined isn't necessarily unreal. But any time the reality of anything is regarded as being in any way other than Shiva, this is delusion. The most important and gratifying piece of the puzzle remains veiled so long as this remains the case. In some traditions, like that of Advaita Vedanta, everything that can't be considered to be absolute, eternal, and changeless or formless being is considered to be unreal. Neti, neti, which means not this, not this. The sage Vashista tells us in the Yoga Vashista that either line of inquiry is equally valid. We can contemplate everything in manifest existence as the form, body, and or power of the Lord, which as such is real. Alternatively, we can contemplate all of it as illusory Maya, since it is all subject to change and decay. The important thing is to understand that suffering is one's constant companion in this existence until that, which is a capital T, which pervades and sustains this world appearance is known in full through direct firsthand experience. The attitude promoted by the latter philosophy is one of asceticism and outer renunciation. That is all well and good, but it's not the only way. Sure, mothers, fathers, children, and other relatives are only a part of the whole. The same is true of the earth, the sun, and this entire universe. You can have joy here, but worldly joy is inherently fleeting. Even so, these things need not be despised. Anything we have an affinity for can be embraced and relished so long as we simultaneously embrace its having its foundation in Shiva only. If we can meditate on joy itself, becoming one-pointed on it, it can lead us to progressively more transcendent levels of joy. After all, wherever the mind goes, whether toward the exterior or toward the interior, everywhere there is the state of Shiva. Since Shiva is omnipresent, where can the mind go to avoid him? Specific methods of this are discussed and explained in my So You Want to Meditate, a meditation handbook and commentary on the above-cited Vijnanabhairava Tantra. All the students of this Swami have that particular handbook given to them. Adida Samraj, who we've mentioned earlier in the book, once said, "If you do not practice happiness, you will also never realize it." Number 69. Shiva said to Parvati, "To that one by whom all this universe is seen, by whom the three states of consciousness, waking, dreaming, and deep sleep are experienced, and by whose power the mind and intellect function, to such a guru, I offer my respects and reverence." Swami Anantanandagiri's commentary. It is the fourth state, called Turiya, which pervades the other three. The guru is Turiya, the ever-present witness, which threads through the three states we just mentioned, waking, dreaming, deep sleep. Like a thread through a strand of pearls. The Shiva Sutras describe the various states of consciousness thus. The bliss of Turiya, or the fourth state of consciousness, arises even during the different states of waking, dream, and deep sleep. The waking state is perception. It is the state in which the big S self is in direct contact with the objective world. The dream state is mental activity. Its contents consist of the mental processes which occur in isolation from the objective world. The deep sleep state is the inability to discriminate, which is caused by the power of illusion. This state is characterized by the absence of perception, since the knowing faculty has ceased to function. The Supreme Lord Shiva is the witness or enjoyer of the three states of waking, dream, and deep sleep. Swami Anantananda's commentary continues. Experience of nothingness, similar to that experienced in deep sleep, can occur in meditation. It should be noted that Kashmir Shaivism posits that nothingness is not the end-all be-all. If the experience of nothingness should occur in your meditation, it is a milestone and it has a purpose. But it's not the end of the road. This experience is a state beyond the mind called nirvikalpa samadhi. But the state experienced in such a samadhi cannot be the pinnacle of reality. If everything resolved into a nothingness devoid of being, as some theories have posited, how would there be the sense of continuity that exists after rising from deep sleep or meditation? The capacity to remember after the fact that one has experienced nothing indicates some unifying factor. That unifying factor is Turiya, the fourth state, the substratum of the three ordinary states of consciousness. There comes a point, the masters of this tradition tell us, when awareness is maintained in the midst of all these diverse states of consciousness, even that of deep sleep. The goal of the practitioner of non-dual Kashmir Shaivism is, in a manner of speaking, to arrive at and maintain awareness of the transpersonal self, with the big S, who lies at the heart of all experience or lack thereof. The guru is this transpersonal self, and by means of the power inherent in his or her right knowledge, they are able to impart this knowledge to others. In regarding the guru as such, the individual opens themselves up to this possibility. Kindly allow this Swami to add a bit more here. One of the ways that you may note, if you are a practitioner of this way, is that you can, the body can be completely asleep, dead to the world, sawing logs, snoring hard or silent, makes no difference. But you are aware of it. Without dream imagery, without anything, you feel or hear the snoring or the breathing of this body directly, because that which you are needs no sleep and never does. It is always witnessing. It is in Turiya where one can witness the change between the states of waking and dreaming, and then the change between the state of dreaming and deep sleep, and then the change between deep sleep and waking. can be perfectly observed from the fourth state, which is Turiya, within which the other three states change places throughout the day. Back to the text. Number 70, Shiva says to Parvati, prostrations unto the Guru, whose jnana, or transcendental knowledge, is no different from this universe, to whom the seer and the seen are one, and who sees oneness only. 71. One who thinks he knows, in reality, knows not. The Guru neither knows nor knows not. In other words, the Guru is beyond both knowing and not knowing from the individuated perspective. Shiva says, to that Guru, I offer my prostrations. Swami Anantananda's commentary. The Guru Tattva, the Guru principle, exists on a plane that is not dependent upon such distinctions as knower and known. The personal guru, the living guru, who shows the guru principle to others, intimately knows the guru tattva, him or herself. He knows it to be both himself and the big S self of all. He or she knows that everything is ultimately the undivided consciousness absolute. This is a transcendental knowledge. This is the jnana of the completed yogi, the gnosis of the Gnostic, the experience that endows this conviction occurs beyond the sphere of mind and duality. Therefore, it is true. One who thinks he knows has missed the point entirely. This does not mean that it is impossible for one to apprehend the great mystery. This does not mean that a master is a liar simply because he is assured in his conviction. The question is one of where this conviction comes from. It is valid if it comes from direct, first-hand experience. In Plato's Apology, Socrates is portrayed as saying something to the effect of, I am wise because I know that I know nothing. There is the possibility that he was simply being clever. After all, to know that, with a capital T, which is literally no thing, is the wellspring of all wisdom. On the other hand, Plato may very well have intended for us to take his teacher's words at face value. Perhaps he was simply an ignorant human being, or at least being portrayed as one, albeit one who was at least willing to acknowledge his own shortcomings. Certainly, it is admirable for one to be honest with others and even more so with themselves. As Socrates describes here, I am wiser than this man, for neither of us appears to know anything great and good, but he fancies he knows something, although he knows nothing. In this trifling particular, then, I appear to be wiser than he, because I do not fancy I know what I do not know. Swami Anantanandagiri's commentary continues, "This is a noble stance to take, and I respect it. However, I do not think that the intent of Plato in penning these words was to cast aspersions upon those who admit they know what they do actually know. Furthermore, even if Socrates was neither enlightened nor being portrayed as enlightened by his student Plato, it would be foolish to assume that he was necessarily the pinnacle of human potential simply because he was a famous philosopher. Lack of knowledge does not prove its attainment as an impossibility. The various traditions of India are full of tales of the otherworldly siddhas, the perfected beings, who transcended their worldly nature through knowledge of the divine while still embodied here on earth. Although they have perhaps not been quite so venerated elsewhere, siddhas have been born all over the world. It is my belief that the Lakota medicine man, Black Elk, the Italian Catholic friar, St. Francis of Assisi, are two historic examples. Socrates may or may not have been one of these. In either case, the notion that has been inferred from the words attributed to him and handed down to us, that the acknowledgement of ignorance is as good as it gets, is just plain wrong. Next week, here on type1radio.com, we will take off from number 72. Here on Meditative Living, Namaste and Blessings.